Happy holidays. Welcome to the Old Time Radio Hour. I'm your host, Justine Ward, inviting you to listen to two funny and heartwarming Christmas programs from radio's heyday. First, we have a crime drama, and then a selection from family theater that both bring a smile during the Christmas season. This Is Your FBI ran 8 years from 1945 through 1953, and its writers were allowed access to some FBI files to dramatize true stories, although the names were always changed, of course. The FBI liked the propaganda value of hoping to convince the public they always got their facts right, especially as they joined the communist witch hunt of the 1950s. Today we have a very entertaining story of a vaudeville comedian reduced to playing Santa Claus at a children's party to support his family. Enjoy This Is Your FBI, The Innocent Santa Claus, first broadcast December 21st, 1951 on ABC.
The Equitable Life Assurance Society presents This Is Your FBI. This Is Your FBI, the official broadcast from the files of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Presented, transcribed as a public service by the Equitable Life Assurance Society of the United States and the Equitable Society's representative in your community. A-H-O. A-H-O. If you contemplate placing a mortgage on your home, it will pay you to remember those letters. They stand for the Assured Home Ownership Plan of the Equitable Life Assurance Society, a money-saving, home-saving plan designed to speed the day when you can say,
"No mortgage on my house. I own it free and clear."
If that appeals to you, please listen carefully in about 13 minutes for full information on the Equitable AHO plan. Tonight, the subject of our FBI file, armed robbery. It's titled, The Innocent Santa Claus.
Nearly all criminals are emotionally childish, undependable, and unscrupulous. Some, like the characters you'll meet in tonight's dramatization from FBI files, are more vicious than others. But make no mistake about it. The dashing and charming Robin Hood types are few and far between. Criminals taint with unhappiness the lives of all those with whom they come in contact. The little niceties of life, the decent, courteous kindnesses, the Christmas spirit itself, that make up normal people's lives are completely foreign to the vast majority of them. Whatever they do is for themselves alone. One of your FBI's major purposes in bringing you these programs is to present the underworld as it really is, without glamour, without sentimentality. Tonight's FBI file opens in a cheap hotel room in the downtown district of a large eastern city. A 12-year-old girl is alone in the room. She walks to a full-length mirror on the wall and sings a song. When she finishes, she bows to the mirror.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your kind applause. That was a great act, but we've got a long show. So let's meet a star who needs no introduction.
Wait a minute, wait a minute.
I didn't hear you come in.
Honey, you ought to know better than to try to bring on a star that way.
Oh, but I was just trying to have a...
What theater were you playing?
The one I'm named after.
All right. You're on the stage at the Roxy. A sensational flash act has just finished.
Mm-hmm.
Now your star is on next. So you want to give her a bill, huh?
But, Daddy, you always say, and now a star who needs no introduction.
I know I do. But then I introduce them.
Oh.
And I tell a couple of jokes. Like, as I was coming in the stage door tonight, a bum came up and asked me for $2 for a cup of coffee. And I said, $2 for a cup of coffee? Why, you can get one for a nickel. And he shrugged his shoulder and says, well, can I help it if I'm a big tipper? Now you got the audience going, see? So you slug him again.
Mm-hmm.
You say, that bum is sure crazy. I met him yesterday, too, and he asked me for $8 for a piece of pie. And I said, $8 for a piece of pie? Well, man, you can get one for a dime. And he shrugged and says, mister, do I tell you where to eat? Now they're warmed up, see? And you bring on your star. You get it?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Oh, say, anybody call me?
Oh, Pete Morrow.
Pete Morrow, what do you want?
I don't know. I got the message at the desk.
Hey, maybe he's got some action.
Gee, Daddy, you think so?
Well, he's my agent, Eddie. He wouldn't call to find out how I was. Hey, maybe they need some next-to-closing insurance at the palace. Can be anything.
Wow-wee!
Well, come on. Hit me with a good luck kiss, and I'll go see him. Hi, Pete. Say, sorry to keep you waiting.
Yeah. Oh, hello, Fred.
I just got your message, and let me tell you, brother, I am ready. I got two new routines, and I got a kid writing me a parody on Melancholy Baby. Ho, ho. Wait till I give you the opening. I come out in a broken-down suit, see?
Hey, Fred, I didn't call you for a theater job.
Oh, that's okay. I do just as good in nightclubs. I'll just move the song up.
Wait a minute, Fred. This ain't a nightclub job either. A guy uptown called me this morning, and he's having a Christmas party for some kids at his house tonight. He wants a guy to play Santa Claus.
And you called me for that?
That's it.
Now, look, Pete. I know Vaudeville's dead, but there's still a lot of places where I can...
There's 25 bucks in it.
Well, look, I give my dresser more than that.
Fred, look, I better level with you. Vaudeville ain't dead, but you are. I couldn't book you in a charity bazaar.
You couldn't book Abraham Lincoln at a patriotic rally.
You want the job or not?
No.
Okay, then I'll get somebody else.
Well, go ahead.
Oh, Fred. By the way, how's your kid these days?
Great.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. She eating good?
Well, sure. I got to cut her down. She's getting a little heavy. Well, she's even...
Yeah? Even what?
Okay. I'll do it.
Your Santa Claus outfit's right there in that box. A car will pick you up in front of your hotel at 7. Now, you'll be ready.
Daddy, how'd you make that?
Wait till I get rid of this box. Now I'll take that hug.
Oh, Daddy, what happened?
Well, Pete Mara told me Oscar Hammerstein says he positively can't do his next show without me. And so that put Pete in the spot.
Why?
Well, Max Gordon's got a script. And he told Pete if I don't do it, he'll never hire another actor from him. And...
Oh, the spaghetti!
Oh.
Ouch!
Did you burn yourself?
I'm sorry. I didn't keep watching and the water all boiled out and the spaghetti's ruined.
So what?
That was our last can.
Look, you're going down to the grill and eat steak.
But they said at the desk, no more signing.
I'm paying them cash. Now, go ahead.
Aren't you eating with me?
No, honey.
Where are you going?
Well, you see, Oscar Hammerstein is crazy to have me in the show he's doing, but the Angels don't know me. So Oscar asked me if I'd do him a favor and audition.
Oh.
Well, you never saw a guy so sorry in your life, asking me to audition. But I told him I don't mind. I knew the spot he's in.
Can I go?
Oh, no. Not tonight, honey. Now hit me with a good luck kiss and run down and have your dinner. That's it. Now, go ahead.
But, Daddy, I always thought when they did a show, they hired the actors before they bought the costumes.
Oh, they do.
Then how come Mr. Hammerstein had your costume already?
Huh?
On that box it says Santa Claus costume, size 42.
Oh, that. Well, you see, after the audition, I'm going to play a benefit.
Daddy.
Okay. I never could con you. You want to know what a big star your old man is? I'm playing Santa Claus at a kid's party uptown.
You're playing Santa Claus?
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Hmm?
Daddy, that's great. Santa Claus is the biggest star in town right now. Who's bigger?
Well,
Hope, Crosby, the Lone Ranger? They're nothing at Christmas time. Santa Claus and his reindeer are headliners.
Maybe you're right.
Of course I am. It's perfect casting. They finally got a star playing a star's part. Don't you understand?
Yeah, I understand. Thanks, honey.
for me?
You Fred Harper?
Yeah.
All right, get in.
Okay. Hey, who's throwing this party?
Mr. Caldwell.
You his chauffeur?
Uh-huh.
See, look, I never worked a thing like this before. You mind if I try a couple of gags on you?
Go ahead.
Well, I figure I'll walk out and say, I know Santa Claus is supposed to come in through the door, but them chimney sweeps have got a real strong union. Nothing, huh? Yeah, maybe it's a little too fast. How about this? I'd have been here sooner except for one of my reindeer. He showed up late because he went to the movies. It seems he wanted to see the picture because he read the book. Say, pal, was your mother frightened by Ned Sparks? You know, it ain't against the law to laugh in this city.
Uh-huh.
Hey, I thought this Caldwell lived uptown.
Yeah, he does.
Well, then, what are we doing down here by the river?
You, see that sign?
Which one?
Don't!
The following day, on a street corner near the local FBI field office, Special Agent Jim Taylor meets Police Detective Mike Wolf.
Hey, Mike.
Oh, hello, Jim. I just come up to see you.
Oh, what about?
A jewel theft last night.
Where?
Uptown, the home of some people named Caldwell.
Huh? What's our jurisdiction?
Interstate transportation.
Huh?
These Caldwells live in a big house on the Heights just off the approach to the Huntington Bridge. You know where the cloverleaf turn begins.
Yeah.
Well, they were having a Christmas party last night for their children and some neighborhood kids. Mr. Caldwell went all out and hired an actor to play Santa Claus. Santa Claus stuck up the place.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Tied up the children, the Caldwells, and their help, and then he emptied Mrs. Caldwell's jewel case.
Hold it. Hold it, Mike. Yeah. Lights against it. How much did Santa grab at the party?
About $15,000 worth of jewelry and $300 in cash.
Oh, that's quite a haul.
After he left, one of the parents wiggled over to a window and saw him drive across the bridge.
How'd they know it was a thief's car?
Oh, it had a broken taillight, so they could follow it all the way.
Uh-huh.
The alarm's already gone out on the car.
Come on, go on. Mike, any prints found around the place?
I haven't been up there yet, but I doubt we'll come across any. Part of the Santa Claus outfit was a pair of rubber gloves.
Oh, I see.
Well, we won't need the prints for identification, though. We know who Santa Claus was.
How?
Mr. Caldwell told me he was hired through a theatrical agent named Pete Morrow. I contacted Morrow and learned that he sent an actor named Fred Harper.
Find out where he lives?
Yeah, at the hotel vending. I called there, but his room didn't answer.
You interviewed the victim, yet?
No, I was going to do that now.
Okay. I'll go over to Harper's hotel.
What do you want, Mac?
Hello there. I'm Special Agent Taylor of the FBI. Here are my credentials.
What can I do for you?
Will you please ring Mr. Fred Harper's room?
He's not in. His little girl's been looking for him, too. Seems he didn't get home last night.
Oh, you know Harper?
Very well. I was once his straight man. Is he in trouble?
Yes, he seems to be.
Mr. Barry, have you heard from my daddy yet?
No, I haven't, Roxy. Mr. Taylor, this is Harper's daughter, Roxy. Mr. Taylor's from the FBI.
Hello there.
Do you know where my daddy is?
Well, no, I don't.
Can you help me find him? I mean, please.
We'll do our best, Roxy. Did you see your father last night?
Yes, sir. He was going to play a party as Santa Claus.
Mm-hmm. Were you here when he left?
Yes. A man called for him.
You see this man?
Only from the window. He was in a big car. Daddy got in and went with him.
Mm-hmm. What kind of a car was it?
I don't know.
Or was it a sedan, a convertible?
A sedan.
What color?
I couldn't tell. But I do remember one thing. One of the lights in back was broken.
Oh?
Mr. Taylor, why are you asking me all these questions?
Well, Roxy, somebody came to that party wearing a Santa Claus outfit and held up the people.
A real hold-up? Yes. With a gun?
That's right.
Not yes. Daddy. He couldn't do anything like that. He's not a crook.
Mr. Taylor, phone call for you.
Oh, thanks.
Please believe me, Mr. Taylor.
I'll be right back, Roxy.
You can take it on that phone.
Fine, thanks. Hello.
Hey, Jim. This is Mike Wolf.
Yeah, Mike.
Fred Harper's been picked up.
Oh, where?
Near the approach to the Huntington Bridge. And two of the stolen pieces of jewelry were found in his pocket. Yeah.
We will return in just a minute to tonight's exciting case from the official file, which shows how your FBI helps promote America's security. And now, listen to the most important security letters in the lives of thousands of homeowners. A-H-O.
A is for assured.
H is for home.
O is for ownership.
The Assured Home Ownership Plan of the Equitable Society. It's America's finest plan of home ownership because it gives four special benefits not always found in other mortgage plans.
First benefit, an equitable AHO plan gives you a way to pay off your mortgage years ahead of time.
That's right. One of the big objectives of this Equitable Society plan is to speed the day when you can proudly say,
no mortgage on our house, we own it, free and clear.
Here's why this can happen so fast. Every Equitable AHO plan combines a low-cost first mortgage with life insurance protection. One monthly payment takes care of both. Thanks to the insurance element, a constantly growing cash loan fund is created. Year by year, the mortgage grows smaller and the cash loan fund larger until it actually is big enough to pay off what's left of the mortgage. This explains how hundreds of AHO families pay off their 20-year mortgages in about 14 years. That's 6 years ahead of schedule.
Second benefit of an Equitable Assured Home Ownership Plan. If the owner dies, his widow doesn't inherit a mortgage. She inherits the home, free and clear.
And what's more, the Equitable Society not only cancels the mortgage, but also returns to the widow every cent her husband had paid to reduce the principal.
Lastly, this plan is a money saver at all times. The mortgage draws interest at only 4%.
So for many reasons, a man may consider himself lucky if his health, age, income, and the location of his home enable him to qualify for an Equitable Assured Home Ownership Plan. For full information, see your Equitable Society representative or write care of this station to the Equitable Life Assurance Society. Remember, the sooner you start an Equitable Assured Home Ownership Plan, the sooner you'll be able to say,
no mortgage on our home, we own it, free and clear.
And now back to the FBI file, The Innocent Santa Claus.
We referred previously to the selfishness and callousness of the criminal mind. During the Christmas season, when the vast majority of us are in a genial, relaxed mood, the underworld does not hesitate, even at this season, to strike often and hard. There's no off-season in crime. Being off guard is not safe at any time. The men of your FBI are convinced that it is high time to stop romanticizing gangsters and hoodlums. FBI agents who come in contact with the underworld daily know it for what it is. Ruthless around the calendar, with no days off for good behavior. Tonight's FBI file continues in the hospital ward at the city jail. Special Agent Jim Taylor is interviewing Fred Harper.
Mr. Harper, you insist that Mr. Caldwell's chauffeur knocked you out last night?
Don't these lumps on my noggin prove it?
But Mr. Caldwell says he has no chauffeur and never sent a car for you.
Well, whoever the guy was, he belted me out.
And that's all you can tell me.
Mr. Taylor, do I look like a guy who'd stick up a kid's party?
Well, unfortunately, looks don't mean a thing.
But I've never been picked up even for jaywalking. The only record I got is in the back issues of Variety.
Are you sure you can't remember anything about this man?
Well, he's a tough audience.
What do you mean?
I told him two jokes. Both bops. He never even cracked a smile. Look, my agent can prove they sent a car for me. Pete Morrow in the Central Building.
Yes, I know. Detective Wolf spoke to him. He claims he gave you the Santa Claus outfit and Caldwell's address, and you were supposed to get there by yourself.
Well, he's a liar.
Well, his word is better than yours right now.
Why?
He didn't turn up with any of the stolen jewelry on him.
But I'm being framed.
No, you're not. This case won't be closed till we find the rest of that jewelry.
Albert, don't hold out on me.
I ain't.
Is this all the stuff you grabbed last night?
Except for the two hunks I stuck in Harper's pocket.
Well, the papers made it a much bigger job.
Oh, the papers, the papers. They got Illinois as a 7-point favorite in the Rose Bowl. Can you bet them?
Not me, no.
Well, the same with stick-ups. I once heisted a joint, got 200 clams. Papers come out and say I grabbed 8,000. This is the age we live in, kid. Now, you're going to get the fence this, huh?
Well, I'm not going to tell you that.
Well, why not?
Well, because the next time we do a job, you might take the loot straight to him.
Well, I wouldn't do that.
Well, let's leave it this way. You don't mind, do you?
Suppose I do.
Well, it won't make any difference.
Yeah, then I don't mind.
Fine. You call me tomorrow, and I'll tell you how much we're cutting up.
So scared last night when you didn't come home.
Well, keep being scared. We're still in a jackpot.
Mr. Taylor told me he was coming to see you. Didn't you tell him you had nothing to do with it?
Mm-hmm. But I'm still here.
Oh, they'll let you go.
Oh, sure. When they take this turban off my noggin, they'll move me down to a regular cell downstairs. Great guy you got for an old man.
I know you didn't steal anything.
Thanks, honey. Oh. Oh, hand me that bottle of pills. My head starts coming off if I get up.
Here.
And a little water, honey. Thanks.
What kind of pills are those?
I don't know. Well, here goes. Oh, they taste like chopped up theater tickets. Nothing, huh?
I just don't feel like laughing. Daddy, will you be out Friday?
I doubt it. Why?
I promised my teacher.
Promised her what?
Well, the school Christmas play is Friday. I told her you'd be there.
Well, that's fine. And I'm such a hit here, I think they'll hold me over.
But I told my teacher what a sensational Santa Claus you'd do. Daddy, we've got to figure some way to get you out by Friday.
Well, if you got an idea, cut me in for half.
Isn't there anything we can do?
Sure. Just keep hoping, honey.
Mike, I got a report from our lab on that jewelry.
No, what's the word, Jim?
They found a single latent fingerprint on one of the bracelets.
We've got Fred Harper's prints right here.
Oh, yeah, I've already checked. It's not one of his.
Well, that doesn't prove he's innocent.
I can't help feeling he is, though.
You believe the story about the mysterious stranger posing as Caldwell Chauffeur?
Yeah, I do. Harper's little girl told me about the taillight on that car being broken. There's no way she could have known that if she wasn't telling the truth.
Yeah, pardon me.
Sure, Mike.
Wolf speaking.
This is Captain Gordon, State Police. We've got that car you set off the alarm on.
Where?
One of my men just found it where Highway 81 hits the turnpike. I'll see that nobody touches it.
Thanks, Captain. Come on, Jim. Car's been found.
Yeah, that's the car, all right, Mike.
Mm-hmm. There's the broken taillight.
Now, let's see what's inside. Mike, look here on the back seat.
Huh?
Santa Claus outfit. The pants, shirt. Hood, there's the whiskers on the floor.
Any labels?
Yeah, I'll
take a look.
Yeah. Yale Costume Company, but that's no help. Harper's agent admits running this suit.
Well, suppose we go through the trunk.
Oh, wait a minute. I'll look up front first, Mike.
All right. Police went over everything in the car for prints and was clean.
Yeah, let's take a look in here. Well, these glove compartments are like the clocks. They never work. Ah, there's road maps, instruction books, baseball scorecard. Mike, rubber gloves. Let's head back to town and get these to the lab.
Hello, Pete.
Well, Fred, how come they let you out?
Mr. Taylor here can tell you.
Oh, Taylor?
Yes, I'm a special agent of the FBI. I'd like to ask you a few questions, if I may.
Sure, anything. Sit down.
Thanks. Now, Mr. Morrow, you told Detective Wolfe you made no arrangements to have Harper picked up the other night.
Yeah, that's right.
We found that car yesterday.
The one he used in the stick-up?
Well, the one that was used, but not by Harper. We also found the gloves that were part of the hold-up man's costume.
Oh, so?
So our laboratory got a full set of prints off the inside of those gloves. One of them matches a print we got from a piece of jewelry we found in Harper's pocket.
Well, what's that all got to do with me?
Well, the prints belong to somebody named Al Bedford.
Who?
Mr. Taylor, I told you what to expect. This guy wouldn't give you the right time in Elgin, Illinois.
Mr. Marlowe, you know Al Bedford.
Well, is he an actor?
He's a professional criminal.
Well, then how would I know him?
His record shows you once gave him a character reference when he put in for a parole.
What's his name? Al what?
Al Bedford.
You better be nice to him, Pete. Maybe he'll give you the job booking talent on those prison shows.
Say, I don't know what either one of you guys are talking about.
Oh, hi, Mike.
We caught Al Bedford. I just got a full confession from him. Mr. Morrow here was his partner.
Oh, that's a lie.
Hey, Mr. Taylor. That clears me now, huh?
Yes, it does.
Then I'd better call my kid and find out if it's still time to do that Santa Claus bit.
All right. Mike here can drop Morrow off at the city jail. I'll go with you.
The auditorium's down this way, Mr. Taylor.
Yeah, it's a pretty big school.
Mm-hmm. Got the biggest stage of any school in town. That's why Roxy goes here.
No.
I think she's majoring in proscenium arches. What time you got?
It's 4:15.
Hope we're not late. Hey, you want in on a secret?
What?
I'm scared.
Scared of what?
Walking out on that stage in front of 2,000 kids.
Oh, you've been on plenty of stages.
Yeah, but what do you do with Santa Claus? You can't get hokey. You got to play him straight. Oh, I guess this is the stage door. I saw four kids walk in here wearing halos. Oh, it started.
Yeah.
Guess they got tired waiting. Can't blame them.
You see a little girl around here?
No. Look.
At what?
The old man in the Santa Claus costume over there. Oh. Come on.
Hey, where are you going?
I've been canceled.
Daddy.
Oh.
Daddy.
Honey.
You made it, Daddy. You made it.
Yeah, look, honey. Mr. Taylor and I are going out front now and catch the show.
Out front?
Well, we don't want to hang around backstage here and get in everybody's way.
But you're Santa Claus. We can't do the show without you.
Now, baby. Don't let me down easy. There's Sam Whisker sitting over there on that trunk.
Oh, that's the janitor. He was standing in for you till you got here.
Well, why don't you let him do it?
He's got no Santa Claus material. Daddy, you promised me.
Yeah, but suppose I lay an egg.
You? Oh, Daddy, you're teasing me.
Okay, I'll do it.
I think I'll go out front to watch this.
All right, and thanks again, Mr. Taylor.
You're very welcome.
And Merry Christmas.
And the same to both of you.
Oh, let's make it bigger. Let's make it Merry Christmas to everybody.
And heaven and nature sing. And heaven.
And now we bring you a message from the book of Luke in the New Testament. A message shared with you by FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, every special agent and employee of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. A message also shared with you by every officer and employee of the Equitable Life Assurance Society of the United States. A message which comes, too, from those who bring you this weekly program. A message written in simple words. Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men.
Incidents used in tonight's Equitable Life Assurance Society's broadcast are adapted from the files of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. However, all names used are fictitious, and any similarity thereof to the names of places or persons, living or dead, is accidental. Tonight, The music was composed and conducted by Frederick Steiner. The author was Jerry D. Lewis. Your narrator was William Woodson, and Special Agent Taylor was played by Stacey Harris. Others in the cast were Anthony Barrett, Walter Catlett, J.C. Flippin, Tony Hughes, Bill Johnstone, and Ann Whitfield. This Is Your FBI is a Jerry Devine production. This is Larry Keating wishing you a merry, merry Christmas from the Equitable Life Assurance Society of the United States and the Equitable Society's representative in your community, and inviting you to tune in again next week at this same time to This Is Your FBI. Stay tuned for the adventures of Ozzie and Harriet. There's fun for the whole family when Ozzie and Harriet come your way next. This program came to you from Hollywood.
You are listening to the Old Time Radio Hour, broadcast each week over the World Wide Web. I'm your host, Justine Ward. Next, we have a show that brought religion to the airwaves, and the only commercial message you will hear is an appeal for family prayer in America. The show was started by Father Patrick Peyton of the Holy Cross Fathers. He originally wanted it to be a Catholic show that would broadcast the Rosary, but that was too narrow for the network, and they insisted on a non-denominational approach to Christianity. The show opens with a quote from Alfred Lord Tennyson, "More things are wrought by prayer than this world dreams of." And the end of the show features the familiar saying, "The family that prays together stays together." The show I've selected for you this season is a lighthearted comedy about an angel who was having trouble keeping his halo on straight. Enjoy Family Theater, The Littlest Angel, first broadcast December 21st, 1949, on Mutual.
Family Theater presents Loretta Young. From Hollywood, the Mutual Network, in cooperation with Family Theater, presents Miss Loretta Young in Charles Tazewell's story of a small boy who became the Littlest Angel.
Once upon a time, oh, many, many years ago, as time is calculated by men, but which was merely yesterday in the celestial calendar of heaven, there was in paradise a most miserable, thoroughly unhappy, and utterly dejected cherub, who was known throughout heaven as the Littlest Angel. He was exactly 4 years, 6 months, 5 days, 7 hours, and 42 minutes of age when he presented his small self to the venerable gatekeeper and waited for admittance to the glorious kingdom of God. Standing defiantly with his short brown legs wide apart, the littlest angel tried to pretend that he wasn't at all impressed by such unearthly splendor and that he wasn't at all afraid. But his lower lip trembled, and a tear disgraced him by making a new furrow down his already tear-streaked face, coming to a precipitous halt at the very tip end of his small, freckled nose. But that wasn't all. While the kindly gatekeeper was entering the name in his great book, the littlest angel, having left home as usual without a handkerchief, endeavored to hide the telltale evidence by sniffling. Oh, a most unangelic sound, which so unnerved the good gatekeeper that he did something he had never done before in all eternity. He blotted the page. From that moment on, the heavenly peace was never quite the same. And the littlest angel soon became the despair of all the heavenly host. His shrill, ear-splitting whistle sounded at all hours through the golden streets, which startled the patriarch prophets and disturbed their meditations. Yes, and on top of that, he inevitably sang off-key at the singing practice of the heavenly choir, spoiling its ethereal effect. And being so small that it seemed to take him twice as long as anyone else to get to nightly prayers, the littlest angel always arrived late and always knocked everyone's wings askew as he darted into his place. Although these flaws in behavior might have been overlooked, the general appearance of the littlest angel was even more disreputable than his deportment. It was first whispered among the seraphim and cherubim, and then said aloud among the angels and the archangels that he didn't even look like an angel. And they were all quite correct. He didn't. His halo was permanently tarnished where he held on to it with one hot little chubby hand when he ran. And he was always running. Furthermore, even when he stood very still, it never behaved like a halo should. It was always slipping down over his right eye, or over his left eye, or else just for pure meanness, slipping off the back of his head and rolling away down some golden street, just so he'd have to chase after it. Yes. And it must be here recorded that his wings were neither useful nor ornamental. All paradise held its breath when the littlest angel perched himself like an unhappy fledgling sparrow on the very edge of a gilded cloud and prepared to take off. He would teeter this way and that way, but after much coaxing and a few false starts, he would shut both of his eyes, hold his freckled nose, count up to 303, and then hurl himself slowly into space. However, owing to the regrettable fact that he always forgot to move his wings, the littlest angel always fell head over halo.
Oh, dear.
It was also reported and never denied that whenever he was nervous, which was most of the time, he bit his wingtips. Now, anyone can easily understand why the littlest angel would, soon or late, have to be disciplined. And so, on an eternal day of an eternal month in the year eternal, he was directed to present his small self before an angel of the peace. The littlest angel combed his hair, dusted his wings, and scrambled into an almost clean robe. And then, with a heavy heart, he trudged his way to the place of judgment. He tried to postpone the dreaded ordeal by loitering along the street of the guardian angels, pausing a few timeless moments to minutely examine the long list of new arrivals. Although all heaven knew that he couldn't read a word. And he idled more than several immortal moments to carefully examine a display of aureate harps, although everyone in the celestial city knew that he couldn't tell a crotchet from a semiquaver. But at last, and at length, he slowly approached a doorway which was surmounted by a pair of golden scales, signifying that heavenly justice was dispensed within. To the littlest angel's great surprise, he heard a voice singing. The littlest angel removed his halo and breathed upon it heavily, and then polished it upon his robe, a procedure which added nothing to that garment's already untidy appearance, and then tiptoed in. The singer, who was known as the Understanding Angel, looked down at the small culprit, and the littlest angel instinctively tried to make himself invisible by the ingenious process of withdrawing his head into the collar of his robe, very much like a snapping turtle. At that, the singer laughed, a kind, heartwarming sound. And he said, "Oh, so you're the one who's been making heaven so unheavenly. Come here, cherub, and tell me all about it." The littlest angel ventured a furtive look beneath his robe. First one eye, and then the other eye. And suddenly, almost before he knew it, he was perched on the lap of the understanding angel and was explaining how very difficult it was for a boy who suddenly finds himself transformed into an angel. Yes, and no matter what the archangel said, he'd only swung once on the... twice. All right, then. He'd swung three times on the golden gates. But that was just for something to do. That was the whole trouble. There wasn't anything for a small angel to do, and he was very homesick. Oh, not that paradise wasn't beautiful, but... Earth was beautiful, too. Wasn't it created by God himself? Why, there were trees to climb, and brooks to fish, and caves to play at pirate chief. A swimming hole, and sun, and rain, and dark, and dawn, and thick brown dust so soft and warm beneath your feet. The understanding angel smiled, and in his eyes was a long-forgotten memory of another small boy in a long ago. Then he asked the littlest angel what would make him most happy in paradise. The cherub thought for a moment and then whispered in his ear, "There's a box. I left it under my bed back home. If only I could have that." The understanding angel nodded his head. "You shall have it," he promised. And a fleet-winged heavenly messenger was instantly dispatched to bring the box to paradise. And then in all those timeless days that followed, everyone wondered at the great change in the littlest angel. For among all the cherubs in God's kingdom, he was the most happy. His conduct was above the slightest reproach. His appearance was all that the most fastidious could wish for. And on excursions to Elysian fields, it could be said and truly said that he flew like an angel. Then it came to pass that Jesus, the Son of God, was to be born of Mary of Bethlehem of Judea. And as the glorious tidings spread through paradise, all the angels rejoiced, and their voices were lifted to herald the miracle of miracles, the coming of the Christ child. The angels and archangels, the seraphim and cherubim, the gatekeeper, the wingmaker, and yes, even the halo smith, they all put aside their usual tasks to prepare their gifts for the blessed infant. All but the littlest angel. Now, he sat himself down on the topmost step of the golden stairs and anxiously waited for inspiration. What could he give that would be most acceptable to the Son of God? At one time, he dreamed of composing a lyric hymn of adoration. But the littlest angel was woefully wanting in musical talent. And then he grew tremendously excited over writing a prayer. A prayer that would live forever in the hearts of men, because it would be the first prayer ever to be heard by the Christ child.
Amen. Amen. Hallelujah. Amen.
But the littlest angel was lamentably lacking in literate skill. What, oh, what could a small angel give that would please the holy infant? The time of the miracle was very close at hand when the littlest angel at last decided on his gift. And then on that day of days, he proudly brought it from its hiding place behind a cloud and humbly, with downcast eyes, placed it before the throne of God. It was only a small, rough, unsightly box, but inside were all those wonderful things that even a child of God would treasure. A small, rough, unsightly box, lying among all those glorious gifts from all the angels of paradise, gives us such rare and radiant splendor and breathless beauty that heaven and all the universe were lighted by the mere reflection of their glory. And when the littlest angel saw this, he suddenly knew that his gift to God's child was irreverent, and he devoutly wished he might reclaim his shabby gift. It was ugly. Oh, it was worthless. Oh, if only he could hide it away from the sight of God before it was even noticed. But it was too late. The hand of God moved slowly over all that array of shining gifts, then paused, then dropped, then came to rest on the lowly gift of the littlest angel. The littlest angel trembled as he saw what the boxes opened, and there before the eyes of God and all of his heavenly host was what he offered to the Christ child. And what was his gift to the blessed infant? Well, there was a butterfly with golden wings captured one bright summer day on the high hills over Jerusalem, and a sky blue egg from a bird's nest in the olive tree that stood to shade his mother's kitchen door. And oh, there were two white stones found on a muddy riverbank when he and his friends had played like small brown beavers. And at the bottom of the box, a limp, tooth-marked leather strap, once worn as a collar by his mongrel dog, who had died as he had lived, in absolute love and infinite devotion. Oh, the littlest angel wept hot, bitter tears. For now he knew that instead of honoring the Son of God, he had been most blasphemous. Why had he ever thought the box was so wonderful? Why had he dreamed that such utterly useless things would be loved by the blessed infant? In frantic terror, he turned to run and hide from the divine wrath of the Heavenly Father. But he stumbled and fell, and with a horrified wail and a clatter of halo, rolled in a ball of consummate misery at the very foot of the heavenly throne. There was an ominous and dreadful silence in the celestial city. A silence complete and undisturbed, save for the heartbroken sobbing of the littlest angel. And then suddenly, the voice of God, like divine music, rose and swelled through paradise. And the voice of God saying, "Of all the gifts of all the angels, I find that this small box pleases me the most. Its contents are of the earth and of men, and my son is born to be king of both. These are the things my son too will know and love and cherish, and then regretful will leave behind him when his task is done. I accept this gift in the name of the child Jesus, born of Mary this night in Bethlehem." There was a breathless pause. And then the rough, unsightly box of the littlest angel began to glow with a bright, unearthly light. Then the light became a lustrous flame, and the flame became a radiant brilliance that blinded the eyes of all the angels. None but the littlest angel saw it rise from its place before the throne of God. And he, and only he, watched it arch the firmament to stand and shed its clear, white, beckoning light over a stable where a child was born. There it shone on that night of miracles, and its light was reflected down the centuries deep in the heart of all mankind. Yet earthly eyes, blinded too by its splendor, could never know that the lowly gift of the littlest angel was what all men would call forever the shining star of Bethlehem.
Star of Bethlehem, holy night, holy star. praising you before us. La 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 la. Strike the harp and join the chorus. La 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 la. Follow me in merry measure. La 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 la. While I tell of yuletide treasure. La 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 la.
This is Loretta Young again. It's been more than a pleasure to bring you the story of The Littlest Angel as a Christmas gift to all of our Family Theater listeners. It's our humble way of wishing everyone a most happy and blessed Christmas. And now, may we remind you, as we do each week, that the family that prays together stays together.
More things are wrought by prayer than this world dreams of.
From Hollywood, Family Theater has presented Miss Loretta Young, who has told you the story of The Littlest Angel by Charles Taswell. Music and choral numbers were composed and conducted by Harry Zimmerman, and the production was directed for Family Theater by Jaime Del Valle. Jeffrey Silver was heard as The Littlest Angel, and Ken Christie as The Understanding Angel. This series of Family Theater broadcasts is made possible by the thousands of you who felt the need for this type of program, by the Mutual Network, which has responded to this need, and by the hundreds of stars of stage, screen, and radio who have so unselfishly given of their time and talent to appear on our Family Theater stage. To them and to you, our humble thanks. This is Gene Baker inviting you to join us next week when your Family Theater will present Pat O'Brien in Count Leo Tolstoy's unforgettable The Cobbler's Window. Join us, won't you? And is broadcast to our troops overseas by the Armed Forces Radio Service. This is the world's largest network, the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Thank you so much for listening to the Old Time Radio Hour. Each week we bring you an entertaining hour from the America of long ago. I hope you enjoyed listening and will find time to join us next week for Bing Crosby, a holiday classic. Until then, this is your host, Justine Ward, saying, so long for now.